Let's start with a cluster of science stories that all, in different ways, touch on human cognition and behavior under modern conditions. A paper published in Neuron, the high-impact neuroscience journal, found that slow breathing measurably modulates brain function and affects risk-taking behavior. Specifically, participants who practiced slow-paced breathing showed reduced activity in the amygdala, the brain's threat response center, and made more conservative risk assessments in decision tasks. This isn't a meditation study in the soft sense. It used fMRI imaging and controlled behavioral measures.
The mechanism the researchers propose involves the vagus nerve, which connects the brainstem to major organs, including the heart and lungs. Slow breathing increases heart rate variability, which is itself a signal to the nervous system associated with parasympathetic rest and recover activation. The HN discussion had people noting that this provides a mechanistic explanation for what meditation and breathing practices have claimed empirically for a very long time, which is valuable because it opens the door to more precise interventions.
The companion story, "Your brain was never designed for this much bad news," takes a related angle. The Science Daily piece summarizes research suggesting that the human nervous system has no effective adaptation for continuous exposure to global negative events. Our threat detection systems evolved for local, immediate dangers that could be addressed behaviorally. When the danger is global, continuous, and unactionable, the same system stays activated without ever getting resolution. The result is a chronic, low-grade stress response that degrades decision-making, empathy, and cognitive performance over time.
The HN comments on this one were notably self-aware. This is a community of people who are by definition reading a lot of news and commentary every day. Several people mentioned deliberate practices, news fasts, time-limited reading, avoiding certain categories of content, and the degree to which they've changed their relationship to information consumption over the past few years. There's something almost recursive about a community that indexes information obsessively, also grappling seriously with the cognitive costs of doing so.
The Lyme disease rapid test is a more straightforwardly good news story. A company has developed a 15-minute at-home test that can detect Lyme disease from a tick bite without requiring a lab. Current diagnosis relies on blood antibody tests that can't detect early infection because it takes weeks for antibodies to develop, by which time the disease may have progressed significantly. This test apparently works differently, detecting tick-specific proteins that indicate a tick has been attached, which enables testing at the moment of exposure rather than weeks later.
Lyme disease affects an estimated 476,000 Americans per year, and the cost of late diagnosis is substantial both medically and economically. Early treatment with antibiotics is highly effective. Late-stage Lyme can cause chronic neurological and joint symptoms that are much harder to treat. A test that works at the point of tick removal could meaningfully reduce that late diagnosis problem. The HN comments noted that the test needs regulatory approval and wondered about false negative rates. A negative test result at the moment of removal doesn't rule out transmission if the tick was attached long enough. Now, this is a good moment to touch on a topic that surfaced obliquely in several of our recent stories: the business and legal structures that govern technology platforms and how they're being scrutinized. We haven't had a direct antitrust story today, but the combination of Cloudflare's expanding platform role, Apple's privacy ecosystem, and SMPTE's standards decisions all sit in a context where antitrust law is increasingly relevant to tech infrastructure. Let me take a minute to ground listeners in how antitrust actually works, because it gets discussed constantly and often inaccurately.
This is worth spending time on. The foundational U.S. law is the Sherman Act of 1890, which has two main provisions. Section 1 prohibits contracts, combinations, or conspiracies in restraint of trade, meaning agreements between companies to fix prices, divide markets, or exclude competitors. Section 2 prohibits monopolization or attempts to monopolize. The key word in Section 2 is monopolize, not monopoly. You can have a monopoly, very high market share, without violating the law. What the law prohibits is using anti-competitive conduct to acquire or maintain that position.
The analogy I use is a race. If you run faster than everyone else and win, that's a monopoly achieved through merit, perfectly legal. If you trip the other runners, that's illegal monopolization. Courts look at two things. Does the firm have monopoly power, meaning the ability to control prices or exclude competition in a defined market? And if so, did it acquire or maintain that power through exclusionary conduct rather than superior products or legitimate business practices? Market share alone is never enough. The government also has to show the harmful conduct.
What makes modern tech antitrust cases complex is defining the relevant market. In the Google search case, the government had to argue that general search is a distinct market from, say, specialized product search. In the Apple App Store cases, the question is whether the iOS app distribution channel is its own market or part of a broader mobile software market. The conduct element is also contested. Apple argues that its App Store review process and commission structure reflect genuine security and quality benefits, not anti-competitive exclusion. Courts have to weigh those claims against evidence of competitive harm.
The practical implication for today's stories is that when Cloudflare creates infrastructure that AI agents depend on, or when Apple controls what privacy information its platform exposes, these aren't just technical decisions. They're decisions made by companies with significant market power, and the legal framework governing them is the Sherman Act's question of whether that power is being used to exclude competition or whether it reflects legitimate product design.
Now, for the part of the show where we interrogate our own confident claims. The story that's getting the most confident treatment in the HN community today is the Linux Sternt PancakeSpy removal. Specifically, the implicit claim that systematic API removal and replacement with safer alternatives is the right approach to reducing memory safety vulnerabilities in large C code bases.
I defend that claim pretty strongly. The track record of unsafe string functions in causing real security vulnerabilities is long and well documented. Heartbleed, Eternal Blue, countless others, the root cause often traces back to C string handling. Replacing unsafe APIs with safe ones that give visible error signals on truncation seems like an obvious improvement.
Here's where I'd push back, though. The assumption behind this approach is that the replacement API, SDPI, is consistently used correctly in all 360 replacement sites. But the HN thread mentioned that some uses of SternPy were intentionally exploiting the non-null terminating behavior. Those cases need a deep understanding to replace correctly. How confident are we that every one of those 360 patches was reviewed with sufficient depth to catch the intentional non-null termination cases?
That's a fair challenge. Kernel code review is thorough, but the history of security vulnerabilities shows that subtle behavioral dependencies are exactly the thing that escapes review at scale. The assumption that a 6-year mechanical replacement campaign caught every implicit behavioral dependency could be wrong.
And there's a deeper question. Is API hygiene the right frame for memory safety in the Linux kernel? The Rust in Linux project is betting that the answer is no, that you need a language-level safety guarantee, not a function-level API convention. If they're right, then StrengthsPy removal is valuable but insufficient. The remaining C code still has memory safety issues that no amount of API replacement can fix, because the problems are in patterns that don't have clean API replacements. Manual array indexing, pointer arithmetic, lifetime management.
So if we're wrong about the StrengthPy removal being a meaningful safety improvement, here's what to watch for. Look at CVE reports from kernel versions following Linux 7.2. If the rate of memory safety vulnerabilities in areas that previously used StrengthPy doesn't decline, that would suggest the risk was already being managed by other means, and the API removal was more symbolic than protective. Conversely, if Rust and Linux components show dramatically fewer memory safety issues in the same time frame, that would be evidence that the language-level approach is delivering what API hygiene cannot.